Scott Cooper is a former Marine and founder of Veterans for American Ideals, an organization that helps veterans to continue serving their communities after they come home. He also happens to be the Democratic candidate for North Carolina's 2nd Congressional District, and he's kindly offered to join us on the podcast here today to talk about the state of politics in America, the role that media and social media have played in amplifying political polarization, as well as what Congress can do to bring people together across party lines. Hi, Scott. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here. Thanks for having me.
Really appreciate it. One thing I want to get into, because it's sort of a unique aspect of your candidacy, you have spent a lot of time in the Marines. Did you learn anything from the Marines that you think maps on to the political landscape today?
You know, that's a great question, and it's one that has framed certainly my approach to all of this from, you know, my time even before running, after I retired from the Marine Corps, you know, and working in the human rights space and advocacy. If you look at, you know, the military, I don't think anyone asks you what party you're a member of. That was not ever a discussion, although we, you know, debated policy and politics and everything. I served, you know, under presidents, both Presidents Bush, under both President Clinton and President Obama, proudly. You know, they were always the commander in chief. If there's anything I think you learn in the military, it's how to work toward a common mission with people you might not agree with, and quite honestly, not even like. And because there's not an option. You know, at your core, you are all Americans, and we're working toward a common purpose, which is, one, defending the nation, but also trying to help create that more perfect union. And, you know, what I would tell you is in the work that I've done since I retired in founding Vets for American Ideals and that, we're at a moment in our country's history in which, and I like to joke, I am much braver and better looking in many people's eyes than I deserve to be seen. It's what I call the thank you for your service moment. That honestly, 50 years ago, that's not where we were as a country. And I think there's a number of reasons for that that we could talk about in a different forum. But I appreciate that. I get a 10% discount at Home Depot. Now, how can you use that platform that you're given in which you have earned, I think, in many respects, the universal respect of your fellow citizens? Can you use that platform to be a civilizing, unifying force in our country? I would submit you can. It's one of the reasons that we chose to run for office.
Do you think that a lot of that sense of unity that you and your comrades experienced came from the life or death nature of the situations you were in, though? I mean, if there's a failure of team cohesion under those circumstances, it seems like it's likely to lead to someone actually getting killed. Whereas to most people in American political life today, you know, things are relatively cozy, at least in the life or death sense. So, you know, maybe that's part of the problem. I mean, there's something called, I think it's called Sayre's Law. And it says something like, the reason that an argument is so vicious is that the stakes are so low. And maybe some of that is what's driving this in politics, where arguably, you know, you have relatively small differences maybe between the parties, although that might be changing. Do you think that's part of what's going on here maybe? And if so, how could we bring some sense of shared struggle to the table to rally Americans together if we don't have an immediate life or death threat to point to?
I love the way that you talk about that, because the point is, and as we talked about, we were all on the same team and we had to get along. We had to work toward a common mission. On the other hand, if we were having a meal together, if we were hanging around the ready room, if we were, you know, wherever, I remember just knock down, drag out arguments, debates about politics. And it was that, you know, she was a, you know, crazy conservative that we disagree with. And then we have debates on education policy. Hey, we know, you know, that he's, you know, the lefty liberal. I don't understand how he could believe that. And they were fantastic conversations.
And sorry, this was like in Iraq?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No matter where you were. And then at the end of the day, though, it was like, okay, we're all working toward a common mission. I know that politically we don't agree, but you know what? We're here and working toward a common mission. And so that aspect, even to the point, for instance, I mean, I remember having debates about, you know, being in Iraq and debating, like, should we have gone to war here? Hey, we can debate that. And it was an academic discussion to some respects, but we were there. And so we were going to try to figure out how to do the best we could with the hand that we were dealt. There was no use in you know, spending time being paralyzed. Whether or not we should have been at that war in Iraq, we were there. Now, again, the conversations about how we got there, important ones to have, but not ones where we would have demonized each other and said, like, well, I'm not going to go out there and work with you. Nope, we were all there. And I think that's among the things that we've forgotten in our political discourse, is that we can disagree about policy, we can disagree about political philosophy, but how is it that we can't all figure out how to work toward the common good? That means compromise, but it also means not demonizing others that happen to be your fellow Americans.
Is that immediacy, do you think, a prerequisite to getting people to rally around a common cause? Or are there other ways to do that?
I think there's other ways to do it. And so I would say, look at some of the other nonpartisan, bipartisan kinds of things that we've approached, in which both, conservatives and liberals would say, yes, we have a common reason to work together on this. Whether it is, I'll give you one example, for instance. There's been a lot of work done about the need for American leadership in the world. Included among that, the international affairs budget, the foreign aid budget, which has been important to our national security for years and years. I've seen folks, both Democrats and Republicans, say this is critical. For instance, PEPFAR, that, was one of the landmark achievements of the George W. Bush administration. There was, a common consensus about the need for that. And so I don't think it's necessarily the immediacy of it, but a recognition that, we all have a common purpose here. I would submit that we almost got there with an infrastructure bill, because we knew and we know that, figuring out how to fix the infrastructure in America, in whatever compromise we come together on how we're going to spend federal funds for that, is important. So I don't know that's necessarily the immediacy, but we've created a tone in which we identify exclusively with, perhaps what we call a tribe or a party, rather than thinking about how it is that we can work toward the common good. And I mean, the famous political marriage, of 30 odd years ago now, was that between Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan, that worked together. They didn't agree. And literally, I mean, fundamentally different perspectives about what the role of government should be, but passed some tremendous legislation. Compare the 2017 tax bill to the 1986 Tax Reform Act, and you'll see just a marked difference in how that approach was taken.
Well, and maybe this is a good segue into something I really want to touch on. So you have spoken about how people started to think of those who disagree with them as not just political sparring partners. You've talked about how we're shifting to viewing those people as enemies instead. Like, there's some fundamental shift there in groupthink and psychology. Why do you think partisanship, political division, is becoming such a defining, really platform issue for a lot of people? Why do you think this is happening?
I have a couple of theories about it. I don't know exactly, but I know that we have some folks that have sunk to lower levels and refused to be decent and kind and generous. That is, I think, the essence of American politics. It has to be that way. And so they've stooped to that. And that's a tragic portion of it. I'll give you an example. I mean, there are legendary stories of Ted Kennedy going on the floor of the Senate and lambasting one of his Republican opponents, and then having a drink, a meal, a beer with that person. And they knew that's exactly how it was. Yes, they still hung out together. And that was the nature of it. We don't have that today. Where did it shift? I don't know. But as I look at an example, you remember 11 years ago in a town hall meeting in the 2008 presidential race, you had a woman that, was asking a question and to John McCain and said, Barack Obama is a Muslim, he's an Arab. And he took the mic away from her and said, no, he's my opponent. He's a good family man. That was a moment. But also what he missed is, what is wrong with someone who might be an Arab or a Muslim? He's not. But so what if he was? That was also, I think, what was missing in John McCain's response. I'm proud that he interrupted that woman. But again, back to how is it we created demons in a country in which we aspire to judge people based on the content of their character, not the color of their skin or what God they pray to. And somehow we've created demons that, again, are not worthy of what it means to be American.
That point is well taken, especially given that it requires a certain amount of mind reading. In order to be able to draw a straight line from, he's Arab or Muslim or whatever, to he does not have the best interests of the United States at heart, there's more than a little bit of mind reading that needs to go on in order to make that leap happen. Like you have to say, and furthermore, his attachment to his home country, his faith, his faith philosophy is such that he will not back American interests when other interests are in play. And that mind reading seems to be a real symptom that we're exhibiting now, it seems, more than ever. I mean, I remember having political conversations in the sort of mid-2000s with friends, and it rarely devolved into people telling me, like, I'm a bad person because I back this policy, like assuming that they understand the inner workings of my mind. And it seems like we're doing that more than ever. Do you agree with that? Have you
Yeah.
seen that?
You make a great point there. And if I might go back again to my experience in the military, your sergeant major, your drill instructor had an oftentimes metaphor that we all bleed green, which was that if you had the character and competence to meet the standard, you're welcome in this organization. I have a good friend that's an Army veteran. His name is Adam Babaker, and he would oftentimes tell this story of his time in the military. He is actually a refugee from Sudan who came to America and then enlisted in the Army. He also happens to be Muslim. And during a movement in Iraq, when he was deployed there from Kirkuk down toward Baghdad, they had the chaplain that spoke to the unit, his company of about 120, and prayed for their safe movement. And then when they finished up, one of the sergeants said, "Hey, Adam, hey, can you also like say the Muslim prayer? Because I want that luck too." And what a wonderful way to think about it, which is that it doesn't matter who your parents are, what God you pray to, what your skin color is. We're all Americans. And what we see, I think, today sometimes is that somehow what God you pray to or something like that, what identity you might have, is somehow un-American. Nothing could be further from the truth, but also, again, looking back to the military, it is something that we should also be celebrating, which is the diversity of our country, because we all love our country just as much, no matter, again, where we came from. It's a unique thing in this country. I could choose to move to France or Germany, Jeremy, but I would never become French or German. On the other hand, someone can come from some far reaches of the world, whether it is, the Democratic Republic of Congo, from Europe, from South America, and could come to America, work toward becoming a citizen, and then become American. I mean, we see it every day in those amazing ceremonies. I mean, I have been to a number of citizenship ceremonies, especially for many of the interpreters and translators I've served with in Iraq and Afghanistan. And, again, their proudest moment was when they took that oath of office to become an American citizen.
It sounds like you're reinforcing the idea of America as itself being more an idea than a nationality even, or a race or an ethnicity, which obviously is a big part of the sort of the thesis of American exceptionalism. Is there a sense in which we're sort of losing touch with that? I mean, that we're losing the cohesion around that idea that would have unified us in the past?
I think there is, but it's also temporary, and it's not the first time we've seen something like this. You'll recall when there was an anti-immigration sentiment almost 100 years ago when we closed down Ellis Island and passed the Immigration Act of 1924. There was quotas in which we would only allow the number of people from Northern Europe, which is what they were trying to sort for, rather than keep these Southern Europeans out. And it wasn't until we had the Immigration Act in 1965 that changed that. And so I think there is periods in American history when we have not remembered that America is an idea. And yet, you look at, for instance, that amazing speech that John McCain gave at the National Constitution Center, 2017, in which he talked about America, this experiment is in fact about an idea, that we are, all endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, for instance. Not that our birthright or blood and soil are fundamental to who we are. I've oftentimes talked about, Jeremy, you could move to Germany or France and never become German or French. But someone can come to America from some far reach of the globe, whether it's Germany or France, or from Eastern Europe, from South America, from Africa, and they can become an American. We've seen that every day. I've been to a number of naturalization ceremonies, especially for interpreters and translators that I served with in Iraq and Afghanistan. Seeing that proud moment when they take the oath of office, you know, and certainly for me, it's an emotional event. And also recognizing, especially for instance, for some of those Iraqi interpreters and Afghan interpreters, they had already acted on that oath to support and defend the Constitution, supporting us in those countries. And then to see them, you know, at once become an American, it's exciting. That's who we are.
I definitely agree. And this generally seems like a dimension of the conversation that's lost on the fringes of both the Democratic and Republican parties. Just this idea that on the one hand, we should be open to immigration, especially to the types of immigrants who are in a position to contribute to the prosperity of the country, say. And yet, not so open as to just allow anyone into the country, whether or not they believe in the ideals of freedom and liberty that define the American system. More generally, actually, this sort of nuance definitely seems to be lacking in our political discourse, and I think even in private conversations. Is that a shift you've observed, say, among Republicans and Democrats?
I have seen enormous differences. And I think part of it is that both parties have been attracted to their polls, meaning their far reaches of the party. And we've lost the notion that there's something important about being a moderate.
It's a dirty word now.
I don't think. Yeah, it is. There was this wonderful expression that Elliot Richardson talked about being a radical moderate. In fact, he published a book about that. People mostly remember Elliot Richardson as the attorney general that you know, resigned rather than fire Archibald Cox during the Saturday Night Massacre during the Watergate hearings. But also, you know, Elliot Richardson was one of two people that held four cabinet level positions. George Shultz was the other one. And then in this book, Radical Moderate, he talked about the need to have people that would, in fact, work together and be those radical moderates. We've lost that, I think, partly because we have people that see a political advantage to pandering to the extremes, and they also see how easy it is to demonize your opponents. That's not new to this age. We've done that for centuries and centuries. And so it's much easier to say, you should hate this other person that's my enemy, as opposed to taking the high road, being an adult and saying, no. I happen to be an opponent of this person. I happen to have different ideas than this person. But certainly we all have in common that we want the best for our country. And I think we've lost that.
I think there's a fallacy here that's intrinsic to a lot of human reasoning, where we tend to think that the more radical a position you can stake out, the more heroic a personality you must be. Because presumably you're taking heat, a lot more heat for taking that radical view. Whereas it's almost like nowadays, the people taking the most heat are the moderates. They're standing in the middle trying to tell everybody to calm down. And they're going to take heat from the far left and heat from the far right, from Antifa, as well as from the Proud Boys. And it's everything's polarized. Why do you think that polarization exists? What's brought us to this point?
Sure. I think one of the ways that this polarization has come about, it's not the lack of people's attention span. I mean, we're inundated. It's 24 hours a day. You know, a couple generations ago, we got our news from the morning and evening papers and from the evening news broadcast. And maybe if we stayed up, you know, past 11:30 at night, you know, the evening news broadcast. What we have now is we have filters that have been created thanks to technology, whether it be Twitter or, you know, us deciding that we're going to consume only a certain flavor of the news that validate our own opinions and demonize the other. Walter Cronkite was the most trusted man in the country. And we trusted that the media, and specifically, you know, those news anchors, were going to search for the truth. And when instead we have different sources that talk about things like alternative facts and the like, that's quite dangerous. When we demonize the media, for instance, journalism is actually a pretty noble profession. And when journalists get it wrong, in the worst case, they get sued for libel. but also they get discredited. They get fired if they don't make sure that their sources are correct or that they don't have the facts straight. And we've gotten away from that, because I think what we've seen is that some of our filters that we've chosen to use do not support things like facts, and instead just are looking to excite the emotions of people on each of their sides. And that is incredibly problematic.
Is there an economic component to this? Because the way news is monetized has changed radically from prior to the turn of the 20th century, when you had essentially a pay-by-the-hit model, where people were trying to sell individual newspapers. You have the person on the street corner shouting, "Extra, extra, read all about it. Dramatic thing happens, war declared," whatever, like super inflated headlines that frankly align really well with some of the things you'll see from Breitbart, from Vox, Vice, The Daily Wire, today on Twitter feeds. Then of course you have the New York Times bringing in the subscription-based model. The news becomes a lot more normalized because essentially at that point, when you're monetizing based on subscription, you're selling your credibility over the long term. And then this new flip back with Twitter, with the age of the internet, to essentially a pay by the hit, where the hit is a click and you can never take your click back. So as long as somebody can trick you into clicking on a title with a sufficiently attractive or inspirational, divisive, or whatever kind of title, the money's been made, and the journalist therefore looks good to their business. Is there a sense in which the economics of journalism has created a situation where journalists, like the definition of journalism, is changing to being more entertainment driven rather than fact driven?
That's a great point. I mean, we've seen, for instance, the difficulties of the Washington Post, for instance, in which Jeff Bezos bought it out. But I mean, I would submit to you that Katharine Graham and then the Philip Graham, her son that ran a phenomenal operation at the Washington Post, that did not become financially viable. They got most of their funding from advertisements. And during the print stages, and the lack of that, and how the economics of journalism have changed, certainly I think is a contributing factor. And in similar fashion, if what you're looking for is clicks, and to have something that is going to get attention as opposed to what is going to be the truth, that's problematic. Now, on the one hand, you have things like Upworthy that you probably see, on Facebook, that are these, wonderful, uplifting videos that, make you feel good. My mom loves them. but then you also have, outlandish ones that are attacks. And if the measure is, how many retweets did you have? That's problematic. And I've seen that, for instance, in my previous career, post-Marine Corps, before this campaign, when I was working at Human Rights First, was working in civil society. And many of the folks that I partnered with were shall we say, to the left of me. And many times, I would see things that would go out, and just language and rhetoric that I couldn't countenance. And I'd say, what are you doing? That isn't fair, and that demonizes someone that happens to not agree with you. I disagree with that. And so, for me, it was, we're not going to partner with you on this. Or, if I would find some colleagues, for instance, that would have something that was a bit outlandish, I'd say, like, I don't agree with that. You're going to need to change that if you're going to put my name on that press release.
So if we're up against this sort of the economics of media in this way, and the self-reinforcing nature of the media, the fact that we prune our feeds to give us the information that we want to hear, is there a sense in which the solution then really has to come from the consumer? Like, do we j is it just that we have to become more mindful and more skeptical as we peruse our news feeds, or do you see a way in which there's some other sort of solution? Maybe tone setting by politicians plays into this as well.
One, yes, there's a responsibility of politicians to be adults, and to be people of integrity, and not to take partisan cheap shots that seem tailored for cable news. That self-righteousness and smallness of pomposity and pettiness, I mean, it personifies this era. Now, another thought that I have, I will go back to, and he shall remain unnamed because he probably would not all want not want all this praise. But I have a teacher from high school that I adore and that I owe much of my intellectual maturity to, who taught me 1984 in his classroom, as well as To Kill a Mockingbird. And he forced us to talk about it how critical it was to make sure that the facts you had were correct. And the scenario that he used for us, and this of course is the 1980s because I'm old, was people that were Holocaust deniers. Now, how could you, you know, deny that? And, you know, of course, that was also through the lens of the Diary of Anne Frank that he also taught us. And so partly it is incumbent upon us, parents, educators, and the like, to say, no, we must care about what the truth is. And also incumbent upon us as individuals to say, I'm going to be a consumer that is looking for truth. Now, this same high school teacher I have continues to point this out because I see him on Facebook frequently in his retired ages of saying, look, remember, this is the truth. And he's also calling out his friends. He's calling out his former students to say we must care about what the truth is. And so, yes, it is partly as consumers, but I think also, you know, as we teach our children, it is our education process that says we must call ourselves to being better and relying on things like facts.
I imagine a big part of this too is, you know, when you say relying on things like facts, the truth with a capital T and all this stuff, you know, obviously the people who peddle things like Holocaust denial will view that as like, no, you know, this is the truth. And furthermore, I have all this evidence and like, you're the one who's not seeing the truth and so on. Is part of this kind of being open to that tiny lingering possibility and probability that we might actually be wrong in some of our most deeply held convictions that sort of opens the door for discourse with people we might disagree with?
Absolutely. You make a great point. And that is that as an individual, as you consume information and as you bring your own biases into that, are you willing to be convinced that you're wrong? And again, back to, you know, as a parent, are you willing to take your child and say, be open-minded, be willing to be convinced that you're wrong? And I don't see a lot of that in the current debate. And that, you make a great point there. Start from the presumption of, yes, I have my beliefs and my thoughts on this, but be willing to be open-minded enough to be convinced you're wrong if, you know, the logic of someone else's argument convinces you.
I'm still holding out hope that someday on a debate stage, someone's going to turn around to someone else, maybe Beto O'Rourke to Tulsi Gabbard or something, and go, you know what? Yeah, I got that one wrong. My bad. Let's actually change that tax rate or something. I don't know. It wouldn't it be great? Well, one last question I wanted to sort of leave things on, actually, maybe two. The first one being about your biggest concerns. I'll start with a negative so we can end on a positive note. But what's your biggest concern about the Democrats moving forward and the Republicans? What are the things that these two parties are doing most wrong? And then maybe if you have a solution, it might be hard, but if you have one, what would be the remedy?
Well, as you've probably discovered from this conversation, I proudly declare myself a radical moderate in the vein of Elliot Richardson. And so, you know, and don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm a proud Democrat, although, you know, during my time in the military, you know, I never claimed a party. You know, I served the country, and that was really important to me, that we were nonpartisan in the military. One of the things I'm concerned about with the Democratic Party is their fiscal responsibility. We have many proposals out there that would burden our children and grandchildren with enormous debt. And, you know, I think that's with both parties as well. For instance, you know, this most recent tax cut of 2017 gives, you know, 83% of that tax cut to the top 1% of the taxpayers. And it shoulders us with $1.9 trillion of debt. That's a problem. I think the other thing with the Democratic Party is what do they stand for? And that's really, really important, I think, for a party to have a sense of what is it that we stand for. I would submit to you, for instance, for me, you need to stand for the greatness of our diversity as a country. You need to stand for the notion that the solutions to some of the most challenging issues of the day are not just the government, but our public-private partnerships, for instance, and that also just lay the groundwork for those people to pursue the American dream, not that we're just going to give handouts. And so that's, I think, really something important for the Democratic Party to come to terms with. As I've seen much of the rhetoric from these two dozen odd presidential candidates, trying to promise so much but not thinking or sharing how they would pay for something like this. That's troublesome. On the Republican side, I'm really concerned that the political philosophy that has underpinned the Republican Party has been lost or perhaps stolen. I'll give you an example. I have great respect for Ronald Reagan, and he helped us believe again in America. And of course, he didn't have a perfect tenure as president. No one ever does. But his final speech to the country, many people don't remember. It was January 11th of 1989, and in that speech, he told a nautical tale, and it was about the USS Midway that was at sea in the South China Sea, and that ship came upon a boat of refugees. They put their launch out, and as the launch was going to assist these refugees from Southeast Asia, one man aboard that refugee boat waved at the sailor and said, "Hello, American sailor. Hello, Mr. Freedom." That's a story that is Reagan-esque, of course, it's the way he told it. It's a wonderful speech. But that was not us looking at people seeking refuge or the immigrant's dream or what we claim to be as a country and fearing them. And that's among the concerns that I have, is that we have created what previously I think was a bit of despair and perhaps some anger, and turned it into fear. And that's quite dangerous. And so I hope that the Republican Party can recover that. I care, for instance, a great deal about securing our southern border. And I've tried to secure borders many times in my own life. The one especially that rings true was the border between Iraq and Syria, near Al-Qa'im. And that was important because we needed to secure that. It wasn't building a medieval wall. It was figuring out what technologies we could have to prevent insurgents from pouring into Iraq. And so, what we have instead is a platform based on fear and demonizing many people that are fleeing conflict. That in previous history, we would have said, yes, that is the beacon that we are to the world. That we turn the corner on that and don't instead look to the other in a fearful way.
Maybe that can be a good lead into this final, hopefully more optimistic note. How do you think Congress can generally set a more bipartisan and less polarizing tone moving forward?
I love that term bipartisan, and I've spent a lot of time talking about that in the campaign trail. If you were to look at the website, it doesn't say Democrat, 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 Democrat. It says country over party. It says we need to do the hard work of governing. And so I think that's one of the ways that we do this, is that we don't run on a harshly partisan campaign. But then also, if you look, for instance, at the Problem Solvers Caucus, I'm heartened by that. That seems to be a close kin to the Blue Dog Democrats and those other kinds of coalitions that we saw before, which is a marked contrast to the Tea Party and the Freedom Caucus, which was not bipartisan and really turned out to be quite obstructionist in being able to prevent things from happening rather than passing good legislation. I mean, it's the reason, for instance, that John Boehner was ousted as Speaker of the House. And so I think that we do is we find a way to sit down and have bipartisan solutions. It still happens. If you look at the National Defense Authorization Act every year, it does happen. In the conference committee that will come out of that, we see that. That still is the one area that we do find bipartisan consensus and compromise is in the defense bill. We can find it in other ways. It's going to take leadership. It's going to take compromise. It's going to take people that have the moral courage and reach out to the other aisle. And so, again, that's where, again, it's going to take leaders. I also happen to think that perhaps those veterans in Congress may well be the ones that could be one of the keys to that. I've oftentimes joked that, among the first people that I would hope to sit down with if we succeed in this endeavor are folks like Mike Gallagher and Adam Kinzinger, both of whom are Republicans, one from Wisconsin, one from Illinois, but as veterans, You know, that's something that you have in common. And you can say, all right, where do we start? What do we have in common? And you would have a trust that's immediately established. Just like you see somebody walking around on the street with a dark blue cap that says veteran, whether it's Korean War veteran, Vietnam veteran, you can immediately say, hey, you know, I served too. And you got a rapport. And that's one of the things I think that may well be one of the keys to this.
And maybe in general, for the population as a whole, finding points of commonality, any excuse really to come together that has nothing to do with politics, could be something that that really helps. Thanks so much for making the time for this, Scott. I really appreciate the conversation. If people want to find you on social media, not that we've just spent the last hour or so trashing social media, but if people want to find you there in that bastion of insanity, where can they follow you on say Twitter or Facebook or wherever else?
So they can follow us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is Cooper for NC. And then also on Facebook, we have Scott Cooper for Congress, is our website. And we're pretty active on both of those. I'm not active on Instagram. We have an account, but I'm just not that interesting. So Twitter and Facebook is a good place. And then certainly we have our website, which is cooperfornc.com.
Fantastic. We'll make sure to link to that in the description. Thanks so much, Scott.
Thanks, Jeremy.